Dolores Kelly from the SDLP in the studio. Good morning, Dolores.
Good morning, Stephen.
It's all go at the Co today.
Oh, it's all go every Friday, especially coming up so close to Christmas, I
think. I came rushing in here. I'm totally disorganised. No doubt you're going to get the better of me today.
Oh, Stephen, I would be a good and getting the better of you now, wouldn't I?
But first of all, thank you for coming in.
I
do think it's in the interest of democracy mm-hmm. that politicians mm-hmm. make themselves accountable. And I was talking to your party leader, calling me sweet on the phone, and that's what he said to me, that democracy and part of being a politician is being accountable. So I'm very grateful for you coming in, and I know these things aren't easy. Okay?
Oh, no, thank you. Stephen, I think you're right. I mean, it is right and proper that the people have an opportunity to hold their politicians account, not only through the ballot box, but also to hear what our plans are, should we be able to get into power and be able to use that power effectively in the interests of them.
Okay. And I guess my function today, like with every other political party, and what the Nolan Show does as part of BBC Northern Ireland's wider election coverage, is we try to go into the detail mm-hmm. of the manifesto. Page one in your manifesto, you say, but Brexit's all over it. This is a message from your leader, Colm Eastwood. Brexit's throughout his message. And he says, with no government in Stormont and no anti-Brexit voice for Northern Ireland and Westminster, people here have had their voices silenced. This election provides a unique opportunity to reclaim your voice and demand delivery. But of course, if we go further on down this, is this not misleading? Because you talk about, and your leader talks about, an obsessed Tory administration in Downing Street wanting to railroad a hard Brexit on communities here at any cost. It's not a hard Brexit here. Boris Johnson's deal is actually providing a situation in Northern Ireland where it's anything but a hard Brexit.
Well, there's no such thing, in our view, as a good Brexit. We would want to see a Brexit cancelled, and our MPs will vote with progressive MPs, of whom there are hundreds in the House of Commons, who want to remain, and we would want to revoke, in the first instance, Article 50. If that's not possible, then we would want a second referendum where the options, including whatever deal Boris Johnson finally puts before Parliament again, is put before the people, so the people have their say.
But you've avoided the question, Dolores, which is, my point to you is that you're describing this and you're possibly trying to use scare tactics using the terms hard Brexit, when you know that actually Boris Johnson's deal, it delivers tariff-free trade between Northern Ireland and the EU. But that would continue. It is not a hard Brexit. So why are you describing it as a hard Brexit in Northern Ireland?
Well, it's not just the SDLP is describing it as a hard Brexit. Of course, there is the debate and the within unionism in particular about a border down the Irish Sea. The SDLP doesn't want to see any borders, any border between on this island or any border between us and GB, because we recognise that a great deal of our trade does go across the Irish Sea over to GB before onward transmission to Europe. So we don't want to see any borders across these islands at all, or any barriers for any industry across Ireland.
But do you concede, part of the reason why the DUP doesn't like Boris Johnson's deal is because the border would be down the Irish Sea. Do you concede that there would be no trade issue between here and the south?
Well,
do you concede it's not a hard Brexit?
Well, no, I don't concede that it's not a hard Brexit. I don't think anything that Boris
Northern
Johnson...
Ireland?
Who can trust Boris Johnson? Let's be very clear. I mean, Nigel Dodds is feeling the pain, as did his predecessor many years ago, Edward Carson, when he was used as a puppet to get the Conservatives into power, as are the DUP now feeling that they have been betrayed by Boris Johnson. And it's not just nationalists or indeed the DUP that say Boris Johnson isn't to be trusted. Many people, both friends and critics, say the same thing. The SDLP is very clear. We want to remain within the EU, and that's what we will do at Westminster, where our votes and our voices will be heard in the interests of everyone across these islands, both north and south.
Page two, you say within this, under the headline, the battle against Brexit, you say only MPs who take their seats can stop Brexit and stop Boris Johnson. Small numbers will make a big difference to the parliamentary arithmetic, particularly when it comes to neutralising the influence of the DUP. Now, there you are heading out at both Sinn Féin and the DUP. It's actually the influence of the DUP that stopped Boris Johnson's deal. It was the influence of the DUP that stopped Theresa May's Brexit deal. So why are you actually saying, criticising the DUP when they stopped it?
Well, I think the DUP has a lot to answer for in relation to the lies that was told to the British people and to the people here in the north of Ireland about Brexit. There is no such thing as a good Brexit. The DUP and Nigel Dodds in particular is the main architect of campaigning for Brexit and for leaving the EU. False promises were made. Lies were put on the side of the bus in relation to the money that would go into the NHS. So the DUP have found that both Theresa May and indeed Boris Johnson have betrayed the faith and trust that they put in. They run away with themselves, tripping in and out of Westminster. And indeed, the whole debate and debacle around Brexit has held up any restoration of devolution here in Northern Ireland.
But it doesn't, because these manifestos, part of my role is to make sure that you're telling people the truth in these manifestos. And my point to you is that you give the impression here that to stop Brexit, you need an SDLP MP, and you criticise the DUP when the reality is you've got to concede that with the deals on the table, the DUP played a major part in stopping those Brexit deals. Parliament, would you agree with that?
Parliament stopped Brexit.
With the parliamentary DUP, numbers, the Conservative Party did not have a majority, and therefore the DUP were playing a critical role. Do you concede, as an honest politician, that the DUP played a significant part in stopping those deals going through?
What the DUP want and continue to want, their party leader said again last night, is Brexit to happen, but they want it on their terms. Yet small numbers will make a difference.
So
and
far, have they stopped Brexit?
Parliament has stopped Brexit.
And did the DUP, play a significant role?
The DUP stopped the type of Brexit that they want. I mean, they're happy enough for a border to go across the island of Ireland. Let's be very clear.
Yeah, but you want to neutralise. My point here, Dolores, is you want to neutralise the influence of the DUP.
Yes.
But for the DUP being there, his deal might have gone through. Theresa May's deal would have gone through.
With the DUP's influence, Brexit is very much on the agenda, because Brexit, the DUP allowed themselves to be used in order for monies towards the Brexit campaign to be filtered across Northern Ireland, and for the Metro magazine to carry articles which were completely false in terms of what Brexit was going to do for the people of these islands. So small numbers will, yes, make a difference, and small votes in the SDLP MLA's votes will make a difference, but they will make a difference alongside those remain MPs in Parliament who still want to see Article 50 revoked, and they want to remain to be on the agenda in any future referendum.
You talk about a political vacuum, page 2 of your manifesto, and you say in the absence of an inclusive power-sharing executive at Stormont, more and more decisions have been outsourced to MPs in London. While two parties abdicate their responsibility to compromise, come together and govern, Westminster has slowly started to take decisions on issues that we should be taking here. And you say that includes, and you list them, welfare, equal marriage, climate emergency, historical institutional abuse compensation, victims' pensions and NHS privatisation. I suddenly thought to myself, the SDLP have forgotten about abortion. And then I started looking through the whole of your manifesto. My goodness, Dolores, abortion doesn't appear once. Why not?
Well, the regulations are being consulted on currently. Proposal and those regulations consultation, I believe, sometime in the new year.
And because that consultation is there, no better time to set out your position in a manifesto on abortion then,
well,
presumably.
The party policy is that it's a conscience vote for each MLA. The party is very clear and some party members are clear in terms of their support for some of the proposals in relation to that which was recently passed in the south of Ireland, allowing abortion and rape, incest and up until 12 weeks
is that
of gestation.
Your party's policy?
That's not the party policy. That's what some party members and some MLAs will support. The party policy is that we're coming from a pro-life position, and many members of the SDLP will have great difficulties in supporting such a proposal if devolution is put back in place in time to have an influence on the outcome of abortion.
So you've dodged it completely from your manifesto because you're split on it.
I don't think that's dodged. I mean, it has had considerable debate and discussion in the public arena. Well, because we are still hopeful that there will be devolution, that we will have an opportunity for MLAs to vote according to their conscience in relation to abortion. And I know that many MLAs will struggle and many will seek to restrain the availability of abortion here in Northern Ireland.
You don't think that people contemplating voting for the SDLP want to know what your policy is on abortion?
Well, people will know.
Not by reading your manifesto, they won't.
Well, at individual level, I have personally received thousands of emails and cards from people who are coming from a pro-life position, and I've made my views known to them.
What is your position on abortion?
My view on abortion is I'm a pro-life SDLP MLA. I will seek to constrain the availability of abortion here in Northern Ireland, but I will look at the medical evidence and the Supreme Court judgment in relation to that.
And what's your party leader's position on abortion?
My party leader has made his position clear.
What is it?
I believe with yourself, Stephen, he has said very clearly that he accepts the judgments in the Supreme Court. He accepts the difficulties facing many women and having a compassionate approach to women in relation to rape, incest.
So Colm Eastwood supports abortion in certain circumstances?
I think that is his view, yes.
And the SDLP as a party supports abortion in certain circumstances, does it?
I don't believe that to be the case. We're still going from pro-life position. I know some of my colleagues don't support abortion at all.
But will the party ever have a position on abortion?
Well, the party has a conscience vote, and the conscience vote that the party has enabled SDLP political reps to have is common across most Western, most parties right across the Western world.
Sure. And when was the conscience vote given to the party? When was that? When did that become party policy?
It became party policy at a conference, I think, 1 or 2 years ago, Stephen.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Within that same paragraph, Dolores, you talk about things that Westminster, your exact words, your party's exact words in this manifesto, Westminster has slowly started to take decisions on issues that we should be taking here. And one of the decisions that you say has been taken is NHS privatisation. What's the evidence of that? That's what I'm convinced you're not scare tacticing here.
Well, I think we've heard in recent days the amount of monies that is being spent in private agents through private agencies. 44 million to date in this financial year alone has been given to one nursing agency to bring in private sector agency workers to fill the gap within NHS.
But you were part of an executive here that used the private sector and used agency nurses.
And
so what are the decisions that Westminster alone has been taking in terms of NHS privatisation?
Well, I think one of the areas that most people are vexed about is the relationship between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson in relation to any privatisation of the health service.
Sure.
And that is one. The other bit, of course...
But I thought that's what you were getting out of the manifesto. Mm-hmm. And you said that decisions have already been taken with that. What decision has been taken between Donald Trump and the Westminster entity?
Well, it's my understanding, Stephen, I think Jeremy Corbyn highlighted it in recent weeks, where there have been substantive talks in relation to trade deals
between America and
GB in relation to any future provision of pharmaceuticals, for example.
No decisions have been taken.
Well, there have been some decisions around the private sector. I mean, we do see
But you're talking about Trump. The reality is there have been no decisions taken, and you're possibly engaging and using the NHS as scare tactics.
Well, I don't think there's much. I think people are very worried about the NHS.
But you say they might be worried.
I think what we've seen...
But you say decisions, Stephen, have been taken, Dolores.
Stephen,
they haven't.
Stephen, what we have seen is a gradual rundown of the NHS, a lack of investment right across Great Britain and Northern Ireland, so that it seems as if someone in a white horse is running into charge on a charger to save the NHS. So, of course, money is going to the private sector. Of course, people will pay privately if their health is at risk, because our health is our wealth, and we cannot judge people who need urgent medical assistance if they seek to go down the private route. But because of the starvation, the deliberate policy by the Tories to run down our NHS, to not invest in it, I believe is a cynical ploy in order to allow privatisation to become more acceptable.
You say that you pro-Brexit parties are already cooperating. Page 4 now. We need a strong coalition to counter their efforts. That's why the SDLP has already taken unilateral pre-election action to maximise the pro-Remain vote and remove pro-Brexit DUP MPs. So essentially, you team up with Sinn Féin to keep a unionist party out.
Well,
is that right?
No, that's not right. And I know that our party leader, Colm Eastwood, has made it very clear that we made a unilateral decision to maximise the Remain vote. And we looked at three particular constituencies. We have East Belfast, where Naomi Long is running as an MP and has a very good chance of winning. She held the seat before. We also took a decision in North Down. Of course, at that stage, we thought that Sylvia Herman would be running, but there is a pro-Remain candidate in place there. And of course in North Belfast, and we very much over the years have made it clear that Sinn Féin should put the interests of the people here across this island before their party ideology and take their seats at Westminster, where their voices and their influence could be best used and utilised in the interests of all.
But is this election, Dolores, not more important than Brexit? Are there not very many fundamental differences between you and Sinn Féin in this election, which maybe should have led you to the point where you stand in every seat and fight for it? Or does Brexit trump everything
for
the SDLP?
Well, many people believe, and I think the public agree, that Brexit is the greatest threat in a generation, the greatest threat we're likely to face in terms of economic and social well-being.
So it trumps the SDLP's opposition and disagreements with Sinn Féin policy.
Look, Stephen, this was not. This is about Remain versus Leave.
So is that what this election is about?
This election. Although we have seen, and I agree, that increasingly, and on the doorstep, Stephen, people are saying to me that the health service and education are key and critical issues that they want to see devolution here for.
Okay, but and in some of those doorsteps, Dolores, you're not giving people an opportunity to vote for you.
Yes, but Stephen, we also believe, and many people, particularly in border counties, know that Brexit is the greatest threat to a generation. And the reckless behaviour of the Tories and the DUP in relation to the delivery of austerity and Brexit remains challenging.
Okay, so does that mean, fair enough, does that mean that for this election it is the SDLP's position that Brexit trumps everything?
At this stage, and when Brexit does trump and is the greatest threat and challenge to our economic and social well-being.
So it trumps every other policy?
Look, Stephen, our party manifesto contains a wide range of priorities. We want to see devolution restored.
And nobody, in those areas where you're standing back for a Sinn Féin candidate, nobody can vote for you on any of those issues in your manifesto?
Because many of those issues, Stephen, are devolved. Many of those issues are devolved. And if the Assembly is up and restored again, we will be dealing with all of those bread and butter issues. But we will challenge the other parties to act in a collaborative way and not in the way that they did up until the suspension of the Assembly.
And you think Sinn Féin's a good party that deserves a vote?
Well, that's up to people to make their own decision.
You're telling them to vote for Sinn Féin in the areas you're dropping out of.
It's not just Sinn Féin, I'd have to say, Stephen. As you well know, there are three constituencies where we stood aside where there are pro-Remain candidates, and people need to tactically vote. And the tactical voting and the debate between Remain and Leave is not just here in Northern Ireland. It is a tactic that is being used across England, Scotland and Wales, because the people know that Brexit is a threat to everyone on these islands.
But you say a lot in this manifesto about representation at Westminster and how important that is. So why are you backing down for essentially an abstentionist MP?
Well, we would urge Sinn Féin and John Finucane to take their seats.
They're not going to do it.
Well, I mean, that's up to them. But certainly the people are telling us that's what they want. People are saying that the day is abstentionism are over. Well, you know, Steve, but I'll tell you this. It's much better, as I think as Colm has said before, for Nigel Dodds' seat to be taken, for him to have no seat in Westminster and John Finucane to stay at home than Nigel Dodds sitting on the green benches in the House of Commons.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Dodds would have something to say about that, and I'm sure the DUP would argue at least they are there using that vote. Let's move on. There's a lot in your manifesto, to be fair, to your party. The climate, and this is entitled Delivering Climate Justice. And you say, emergency legislation incentivising the transition from a carbon-intensive to a carbon-neutral economy by 2030. My goodness, you can do it a lot quicker than even the government's own top advisers, who essentially say it's impossible before 2050.
Well, Stephen, I think we have set some ambitious targets, and the SDLP, of course, is no stranger to protecting the environment. I mean, after all, it was a SDLP minister that introduced the plastic bag levy that brought 30 million into the kitty to spend on environmental projects. And it was the SDLP minister who introduced a moratorium on fracking. So these are, yes, ambitious targets, but ones that we want to strive towards seeing implemented, and we want, and we believe actually that the EU
But the government's own advisory committee has said there is no realistic chance of hitting net zero before 2050.
Well, we want to have an ambitious target here for Northern Ireland. We want to lead the way, and we are an island.
Are you spoofing people in this?
Not at all, Stephen.
So you're saying 2030, when the government's advisory committee has said this is impossible before 2050.
No, I think we need to have ambitious targets. The United
ambitious
Nations...
Ambitious or totally unrealistic and a
ambitious,
spoof?
Ambitious right. targets, Stephen. And can I just say, the United Nations has said there are some just 11 years to avert the climate crisis, where we will start to see climate refugees. And when you look at the American, North America, and indeed increasingly GB, where they're operating isolationist policies, there is a grave threat to humanity around climate change, and the SDLP has ambitious targets and ambitious plans for the people here.
Well, let's look how you're going to achieve those ambitious targets of net zero carbon, because, for example, air travel is a big determinant. It's a big contributor to carbon, mm-hmm. isn't it? And reducing air travel would be important, wouldn't it, to look after the environment?
Well, it's not just around air travel.
Yeah. Air travel would be...
Well, anything with carbon emissions, we have to look at new technologies, yes, and see how we can do that. And I think one of the things, of course, in Belfast and Derry in particular, is the carbon monoxide coming through cars. And we already have seen reports around the challenge around respiratory diseases for people living in those high carbon monoxide emission areas facing.
If I can stay on air travel, mm-hmm. because, you know, there are some parties, for example, I was talking to the leader of a political party on Five Live last week on the network show that I do, and they're wanting to actually tax people if they go on more than one round trip a year. They think the danger of air travel is so significant to the environment. For a party like yours that is doing what you describe as an ambitious target of 2030, 20 years before the government's own committee is saying is realistic, well, you would have to be grabbing every possibility of reducing any type of climate pollution. But I find elsewhere in your manifesto that you're actually wanting to attract more air travel to Northern Ireland. You want to scrap air passenger duty, and you want to attract more tourists to our airports. You even want to put train links to our airports. So why are you wanting to bring more aircraft into Northern Ireland? And how's that friendly for the environment?
Well, I don't think that air travel of itself is the only contributor and the only thing that it needs to be addressed.
It is a contributor. So why are you wanting to bring more air travel to Northern Ireland and encourage more of it?
Well, we want to build a better economy in terms of tourism. We want to build a better economy and provide better opportunities.
I understand that, but how does it help you hit your 2030 target?
Well, that's something that would have to be looked at, Stephen. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But I tell you this.
But you've looked at it before you put it in your manifesto.
Stephen, people are opting in Northern Ireland to travel via Dublin because there's no air passenger duty.
Correct.
Investment is inward investment. There's no air passenger duty.
Correct.
So we want to have a level playing field across this island.
But do you want to have the same amount of pollution in Northern Ireland or more pollution in Dublin?
It's not just around, and Stephen, as you well know, it's not just around air travel. You've picked one bit out. We are we have an opportunity, and I think the Scottish Assembly has made the same points around an island. We have opportunities for tidal, and we have a lot of wind on this island as well. So there are other green technologies
in terms of
travel.
We'll move on. Other climate priorities. You say you would incentivise green energy production to position Northern Ireland as a leader in clean technologies. Now, incentivise green energy production means tax breaks. For what? Boilers?
Well, I think in terms of What we need is we need to start, I believe, Stephen, in terms of our skills and our apprenticeship base, in terms of the promotion of further education. So
no, that's, all that's all the, that you, no, you talk about that
all,
elsewhere. No,
but, yes, but this is all linked.
I will come on to that.
It is all linked,
and I will come on to that.
But yes, we do need we need to have tax breaks. We need to have incentivisations.
What areas of green energy would you incentivise through tax breaks?
Well, I think we have to look at our opportunities through tidal wave. We have to look at the wind, but we also there are issues around protect. We have to protect the environment. We have to reduce our carbon footprint, and we need to use the best science. And that is part. And we have to look at agriculture as well, of course, Stephen, in terms of the damage that some practices do to the environment there.
Yeah, but so you're not talking about disincentives. You're talking about incentivisation, which means tax breaks. So you would give tax breaks to what?
Well, I believe we should be given tax best breaks to those research projects and to those industries that are seeking to pilot and to design.
No, this isn't about piloting. This is not about that. It's not about piloting. It's about green energy production to position Northern Ireland as a leader in clean technologies. So it's clearly about green energy production, which means something that currently exists and you're going to incentivise us all to take that up through a tax break. Does it include our boilers?
Well, we'd have to look at how and what type of fuel we use. Yeah, we will. But I'm not saying RHI boilers, Stephen, as you know.
So what type of fuel would we be incentivised to use?
Well, any renewable energy, Stephen. We would have to look at what renewable energy sources there are and how they can be best used.
RHI boilers were renewable. They were biomass.
And indeed, many of them, if used properly, it was the scandal in terms of the management of that particular project, which has led us to the state that we're in here in Northern Ireland and the collapse of devolution.
All right. Let's move on to health, because in your manifesto you talk about world-class health services and your vision as a party, a world-class health service delivering excellent care free at the point of need. Perfect point. We'll get into the manifesto in a second. Do you support the health staff that are striking, and do you think they should have pay parity?
Yes and yes. Stephen, I have four sisters who are nurses and three nieces and a son who's studying to be a nurse. So I very much know that the nurses aren't striking just for pay parity. They're very much concerned about the safety and well-being of the patients in their care. And indeed, on occasion, I've heard nurses say that some of their registration could be at risk because of the lack and of qualified nurses on the ward that might be at breaking point in terms of safety. So yes, nurses deserve their pay parity, and we should all bear in mind that this strike is not just about their pay, but it's about the well-being of patients.
But you do say in your manifesto the SDLP will fight for pay parity. Did you fight for it when you were in the Assembly?
Yes.
It was broken.
On the floor of the Assembly, yes, we voted for the pay parity, yes.
Well, here's what Arlene Foster told The View last night about Jim Wells breaking pay parity.
After 5 years of austerity, Jim Wells was confronted with a very limited budget at that time. So he recommended that parity should be broken. That was then implemented through the Northern Ireland budget, voted on by the Northern Ireland Executive and indeed the Assembly. That was then continued later by Simon Hamilton and then, of course, latterly by Michelle O'Neill.
Voted on, she says, by the Executive and the Assembly. Did the SDLP vote against it?
In the Executive? I understand that the way in which the St Andrews Agreement constrained ministers within the executive, that they had to vote along, that our one SDLP minister had to vote along with that, yes.
So you voted for the break of pay parity?
We voted in terms of the difficulty, as a ministerial level, yes, but on the floor of the Assembly, we had a different view in terms of pay parity.
But I thought this whole election is about you saying, look, give us power and we will use it responsibly.
Well,
when you had the power as a minister, you voted for pay parity to be broken. And I'm confused as to why you would have to vote for it. Are you saying you were legally forced to vote for it?
I believe, Stephen, that the regulations in terms of St Andrews tied ministers into voting for. Otherwise,
they could have left.
Well, and eventually the SDLP did leave.
But they didn't. But when they had. But hold on, because this is really important, and it's in the news this week. Mm-hmm. So you're saying about how important it is. You mentioned some of your relatives who are nurses. And you're campaigning, like many other politicians are, for the nurses to get pay parity when they're not in the executive. And when they were in the executive, they did the opposite. Your party had a chance to stand side by side with the health workers. And you didn't walk out as a point of principle. You didn't refuse to vote. You voted for their pay to be less than elsewhere in the UK.
Well, I believe hindsight's a wonderful thing, Stephen, and I don't believe that any of the minister, any member of the Assembly thought that there would be such a gap and so prolonged a breach in parity in relation to NHS pay. And there have been other opportunities where it has been raised on the floor of the Assembly by SDLP members in relation to the pay issue, and we have voted. And of course, Stephen, you have to remember, and Sam McBride's book, and indeed the RHI inquiry, will tell you very much how the small parties were squeezed and weren't fully informed by ministers within the executive. And let's hope that if
That's
and when...
That's about RHI.
Well, it's not just about RHI, Stephen, what eventually led to the SDLP and others walking out of the executive was the way in which the two big parties treated the small parties.
Okay, that's unfair in the context of what we're currently talking about, because you know... And you've said this morning that, yes, your party voted against, voted to support nurses getting paid less here than elsewhere in the UK. So you knew it was different. You knew it was less. Your party voted for that pay disparity. You talk about the benefit of hindsight, and I get that. Do you feel that you, as a political party, should this morning apologise to those healthcare staff for voting to break pay parity?
Well, Stephen, I think the executive overall, when we look at what has happened since that issue was raised and how money has been spent and some of the failures around the executive in relation to the public money spent, then yes, an apology is owed to nurses in relation to pay parity, because nobody...
But you're not here representing the executive.
No, I'm not.
You're here representing the SDLP.
Well,
are you prepared to issue an apology to those health workers this morning, or are you saying you won't apologise to them because your party voted for the breach of pay parity?
Stephen, at the ministerial level, I think it's right and proper that an apology is given to nurses I have no difficulty in saying that the nurses should have been better treated and health workers should have been better treated. This should not have come to this extent and nor had should have been so prolonged.
But part of the role of a political party coming in here is for me to test what you as an individual political party is about. And maybe there will be some people that, you know, they'll think that if you apologise, that's a sign of honesty and integrity. Maybe others won't. So that's why I'm saying it's not about the executive. It's about what does the SDLP stand for? So with the benefit of hindsight, do you feel the SDLP should apologise to all of those health workers standing in the picket line this morning because your minister voted to make their pay less than the rest of the UK?
Well, Stephen, I believe that... from my own perspective, I certainly am sorry that I did not see the signs and the extent in which the pay would fall behind.
The question's about the vote.
The vote, yes.
Because this election is about giving individual standing constituency votes so that they use their discretion.
Sometimes things aren't just yes and no. I certainly am very sorry that the health service is in the state it's in. A lot of that is because of Tory austerity and the deliberate cutbacks and the attack on our health service. And it's also the case that the British government, alongside the DUP and Sinn Féin, changed the Good Friday Agreement to St Andrews and how the executive operated that made it virtually impossible for ministers to vary on their vote.
The reason I was testing you on that, and you are here this morning, Dolores, representing your party, is because your pledge under the health service is our pledge to you is that we will take the politics out of health. We will lead an honest conversation about our health and social care system. And so therefore, part of an honest conversation is being prepared to say you're sorry when you got it wrong.
Well, you know, Stephen, I'm saying I wasn't the minister who was constrained within that. But as a member of the Assembly, if I voted for parity at that time and allowed it to continue without seeing the warning signs...
Well, parity didn't continue, that's the point.
But No, sorry. What I'm talking about is the fallback, if you like, in terms of the pay scales for health workers here in Northern Ireland. If we had foreseen the difficulties in then yes, of course, we would have taken, and I personally would have voted differently and had my voice heard. But can I just
No apology from the SLP?
There's certainly an apology from me, an apology from me that I didn't see and was better informed from my own perspective. I would have liked to have been better informed around the issues around that.
Okay.
But Stephen, I think that has to be set in the context which we were operating at that time. And one point I do want to make in relation to that particular manifesto pledge is around the SDLP leader, Colm Eastwood, offered 2 years ago to take the politics out because whoever takes the ministerial portfolio, we will not play party politics with the implementation of Bingoa because there are some tough decisions to be made.
There are. And that was, you lead me to my next questions because there are very tough decisions to be made. And you say, as the second part of your pledge, we will not shy away from difficult decisions when they're in the public interest. And Bingoa presents, you're dead right, some difficult decisions. One of those difficult decisions in terms of selling it to the public is closing hospitals. Mm-hmm. Bingoa talks about centralising services so that specialities are at fewer hospitals. Mm-hmm. And the thinking around that is that if you have specialist services, then the best people and the best resources are there. And so, yeah, you maybe have to travel further to get there, but you're getting the very best best treatment and the staff are the best and they're there. Which hospitals would the SDLP close?
Well, Stephen, the Bingoa report does talk about closing a number, about exactly what you said in terms of specialism. I can't say offhand which hospitals we would close because I don't think I'm well enough informed to say I'm going to close A, B or C hospital. But what we would look is not only to ensure that the best service is available to anyone in need, but actually that there's all of the surrounding services. There has to be infrastructure improvements, has to be improvements in public transport to enable patients and their families to be able to travel to wherever those specialisms are. So there has to be a comprehensive investment around all of this.
And if a hospital closes, can you at least give a pledge? Because I get it that you might not be across the detail. Can your party give a pledge that you'll not be standing out in protest just to be popular in that locality if a hospital is closing?
Our party leader has given a commitment on behalf of the party that we won't play politics with whoever has to carry the load of the reform of the health service.
All right. So if I can just ask one further question around the health service and whether politics is being played or not, and this comes back to Brexit politics. In your manifesto, you talk about the impact of Brexit on health and social care. And you say in Northern Ireland, 8.8% of doctors come from other EU countries. And you go on to say, in the absence of a functioning executive more than ever, Northern Ireland needs MPs to show up to vote in patients' interests against a hard Tory Brexit that threatens health workforce supply. So the clear inference there is that if Brexit happens, doctors from EU countries will not be able to work here. How is that true?
Well, Stephen, we're not saying they won't be able to work here. It can be made more difficult for people to work here. We are already, in my own constituency office, getting queries from workers across all sorts of industries as to what Brexit means for them in terms of their ability and stability here to raise families.
But agree it would be highly likely that doctors would be allowed to continue from the EU to work here.
Who knows what route the Tories are going to go around Brexit. We've heard Priti Patel talk about a particular skills mix. Who trusts them to stand by their word? The SDLP certainly doesn't.
Okay, let's move on. You talk in page 10 about loneliness. The SDLP believes there should be a strategy to address loneliness in the north. Mm-hmm. You don't say what the strategy is.
Well, there is an all-party group, Stephen, working with our partners and stakeholders, particularly with older people representative groups, who are looking at how we deal with the loneliness. And there has been two
and
recent research.
What's the SDLP's policy on that?
Well, actually, Stephen, I belong to a community group that runs social care centres on a voluntary basis in our community. So it's actually done for a very small bit of money. It actually is working in collaboration with the healthcare trusts and about befriending schemes. It's also about giving a wee bit of capital for the rent and hire of community halls. It's about providing training and upskilling for volunteers that A, allows the volunteers to deliver safely for older people and those that choose to come along in terms of food hygiene, lifting and handling, you know, about vulnerability and about risk, you know, and access to vulnerable people. But it also has allowed, in my experience, people to return into the workforce by providing those very same accredited skills. Okay. So tackling loneliness is something that actually is doable and that I believe passionately in.
Fair enough. And thank you for that answer. If we move on to education, you talk about the curriculum requires modernisation if we're to compete globally. And you say that you would make it a requirement to take a GCSE in a modern language and a requirement that mathematics would be taught to the age of 18. Do you not think 16 and 17 year olds should be able to choose their own A-levels?
Well, that I think is then a requirement that maths has continued to be taught. That's how I read it up until the age of 18. I read it differently.
Right.
Modern languages, Stephen, as part of the curriculum, isn't unusual. When I was at school and did O-levels, we had to do modern language as well. There was French and Spanish. There's all sorts of different languages.
But do you believe in voting 16?
Pardon?
Does your party believe in voting 16?
Yes.
So you believe that someone has the discretion and the mental agility to decide how they're going to vote at 16, but they cannot decide for themselves whether they want to continue with mathematics after 16. You're going to force those young people.
That's not how I read that.
You're going to force them to be taught mathematics to 18.
Well, there can be, you can be taught mathematics in a whole range of opportunities.
But you're going to force it.
No, that might not be an exam-based maths, Stephen. That can be about how to run a household, how to run a budget. And we all have seen
teaching of mathematics to age 18. So what is it?
Well, in my view, there are many young people who get mathematics GCSE but can't run a budget, they can't run a checkbook, they can't manage their own
affairs. Why would you force a young person?
Well, I'm not saying that
to be taught something. A 17-year-old is not going to be able to make their own choices at the age 17 as to what they want to learn in school.
Well, I believe that we have to give people the opportunity across a wide range of curriculum subjects to learn.
You're not giving them an opportunity. You're forcing them to be taught mathematics.
I don't think that's what that says, Stephen.
Here's what it says. The reinstatement of the requirement to take a GCSE in a modern language and the teaching of mathematics to age 18.
You can teach mathematics to 18, but you're not forcing people to do exams in it.
No, but you're teaching them to be taught in it.
Maths is critical to all sorts of
skills-based activities. Why not force them to be taught English until 18? Why not force them to be taught biology until 18?
Many other subjects are English and maths are critical, I believe, to access and many different career pathways.
You believe. But can a 17-year-old not believe it for themselves?
I know when I was 17, Stephen, I had to take advice from many people around me in terms of what subjects and career pathways, and I was happy to get that advice. This is an opportunity for young people to get the broadest range of support mechanisms. Some of them may well have failed at a GCSE level and may want to continue the opportunity to be able to learn mathematics, but not necessarily take an exam up until the age of 18.
In terms of education, because I need to move on here, probably about 5 or 6 minutes left. You'd be delighted to know. Your manifesto includes ring fence resources for our education service. How much extra beyond what we have?
Well,
doesn't state this.
Well,
it just says ring-fenced extra resources.
Well, Stephen, in terms of education, we all know that education is under-resourced across a wide range.
So the question is how much?
Well, that's impossible to know at this stage because there hasn't been an assembly sitting for over 2 years.
So we've just got to trust you that it's a figure between zero and...
Well, I think, Stephen, we all know that it's somewhere around 78 million for the cost of transport, which isn't sufficient. We also know that in terms of the maintenance, there's a huge backlog going into millions of pounds in terms of the school estate, which is one of the reasons why at Westminster, at the beginning of the Parliament, when we look at Infrastructure Commission, we would want a regional infrastructure commission for Northern Ireland, because we know that Northern Ireland infrastructure across our roads, schools, etc., water and sewage has been neglected over the last 30 to 50 years and falls far short of investment.
You would also ring fence extra investment for childcare. You would give free childcare from 20 years per week to 20 hours per week, then going up to 30. You would also ring fence resources for university expansion. None of these costed in this manifesto, but you're promising the public extra money. At the same time, you would scrap tuition fees. How much would the scrapping of tuition fees cost?
Well, Stephen, first off, I think people should know that when our young people are forced to study in GB, that the money follows them in terms of any budget. So therefore, we would want more opportunities for young people. We want the medical school, which has been agreed and just requires a ministerial approval, to be established at McGee.
The question is, how much would it cost to scrap tuition fees, and where are you getting that money from? What's it being taken away out of?
Well, I think our other parties have made it very clear to the Tory government and others that any restoration of the Assembly here will require additional resources coming into Northern Ireland to look, because of the years of decline, because of the years of conflict. We require to be brought up to standard, as in many places across the GB. We would have to look at how, manifestos are promises and aspirations, and we would want to work. Scotland makes it work in terms of...
Maybe you should have looked at their model and then costed it here.
Well, you know, Stephen,
other political parties across the water have lots costed. None of this is costed.
Well, Stephen, you will appreciate that in terms of our manifesto, we have looked right across a very detailed analysis in terms of how we can work better. There are opportunities to invest to save funds in terms of how we better use the resources we have and put it at in place to allow our young people. Well, you know, Stephen,
you keep talking, I'll keep telling you it's not costed. But well, let's move on, because I think we've time for maybe one final question. And it's around LGBT rights, because it's an issue at your party. Well, I'll read your words. The SDLP is a strong and proud supporter of LGBT plus rights. The SDLP leader, Colm Eastwood, you say, brought forward the first Assembly motion on equal marriage that achieved a majority. Where does the SDLP stand on reform of the Gender Recognition Act? Because that's one of the biggest LGBT issues at the moment.
Well, many people within our party would be very supportive of the Gender Recognition Act.
Are you?
I have to see the detail of it. There has to be a party conference. There's a party conference, Stephen, in February of the new year, and I have no doubt that that particular item will be a subject to a party conference vote.
Let me help you with that, because the LGBT rights charity Stonewall say they want a Gender Recognition Act that gives all trans people, including 16 to 17-year-olds, the right to self-determination through a much simpler and more streamlined administrative process. It would require no medical diagnosis or presentation of evidence for trans people to get their identity legally recognised. Does the SDLP support that? That without any evidence or any medical diagnosis, someone can say, I am now a woman?
Well, I think, Stephen,
if they were born male.
Stephen, I think we do need to actually make it easier. There are many people who suffer from mental health disorders because of their gender identity crises and how difficult life is for them.
Should someone be able to self-identify their gender?
Well, I think, Stephen, we also need to look at the other side of that, you know, where we have to look at how we protect people too from those who would use that particular vehicle in order. We've seen a case in America recently where a person has said, I think it's before the courts currently, has said that they wanted to identify as female, was put into a female prison, and now we have a...
So you're aware of that case, your party's thought about it, so do you support someone self-determining their gender or not?
Well,
They've just got the right to self-determine. Do you support that?
Well, Stephen, I think we need to look at the balance and have a balanced view of it. We haven't...
Well, you've looked, presumably.
Well, no, I personally haven't looked at all the balance. I have some concerns around it, but I also am concerned for those people who face mental health problems because of their identity crises. We would want to enable, as far as possible, those people to feel welcome in society here, and we will want to reach out and have a very informed decision at a future party conference.
Right, I've got 60 more seconds. seconds or I'm going to get into trouble. You say the SDLP will support legislation to implement LGBT plus affirming relationship and education curriculum for schools. Mm. At what age is it appropriate to teach LGBT curriculum in schools? Primary school?
I think post-primary on a personal level, Stephen.
But what's the party policy? Because it's in your manifesto. Curriculum for schools.
Well, the
post-primary, not primary school. Is that the SDLP policy?
Well, Stephen, I don't believe that I've had that discussion. And I, in my view, I think it's one in terms of post-primary is best looked at.
What's wrong with teaching same-sex relationships in primary school?
Well, Stephen, you know, I believe children have a right to be children for a long time. And I think we're pushing too much onto teachers and onto young people in terms of very complex relationships.
I give this opportunity to every party who comes in. Every party will be coming in. We don't know if the DUP are going to be coming in. That's the only exception. Why should people trust and vote for your party this election?
Well, Stephen, I think the SDLP has a very proud history of putting people first. We've seen that throughout the years of the conflict. We stood against the men and women of violence. We stood for a better way of reconciliation between and a shared community. We have made bold decisions. We have supported policing in the past when others chose not to. And I think the SDLP has a proven track record of putting the needs of the people first. And that's why I think people should trust the SDLP.
Easy buns today or what?
Oh, no, Steve, it's never easy buns with you, but it's always a pleasure.
Thanks so much for coming in, and
thank
I really
you.
Mean that. Thank you very much, Dolores. Good luck.
Thank you.
And thank you.